again. Welcome to Courage Cocktail Radio Show. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. Good afternoon, loyal listeners and new friends. Glad you're with us today. Today we broadcast the final episode of the five-part series, Long Lives, Long View. We are live inside the studio at WCOM LPFM, based in the heart of Carrboro, North Carolina. If you're local, tune us in at your radio dial at 103.5. Not local? No problem. Stream us live at www.wcomfm.org. Here's the backstory to the series. In case you've missed us, we've been playing a series, episodes 5, of this Long Lives, Long View. And the most important part of this is today we're wrapping up on series 5. We've created and collaborated with our friends over at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill in the Partnerships in Aging programs, which is a campus and community-wide initiative led by Dr. Sherry Rosemond. I encourage you all, visit their website if you can. It is one word, partnershipsinaging.unc.edu. That's partnershipsinaging.unc.edu. Their tagline is delightful. It is linking Carolina to communities to foster new possibilities in later life. Our promotions about our works gathered a lot of attention, as well as these programs. And in the past 5 weeks, we've had guests from community here in Chapel Hill in the Triangle, each one of whom is making a significant contribution to our neighbors and to our own understanding of what it means to age. In brewing this flight of cocktails, it's our hope that we've catalyzed conversations between academics, volunteers, artists, and people shaping the care experience for both participants and their families. So we've invited today as our final guest in the series, Paul Cleaver, the executive director of the Charles House. The Charles House Association operates, and it's called for Community Elder Care, and it provides quality, personalized care to elders and respite for their caregiving families. The locations include Daytime Elder Care Center in Chapel Hill and Elder Care Homes in Chapel Hill and Carrboro. I'm going to read you the mission statement. The mission of Charles House Association is enriching the lives of seniors, supporting families caring for aging family members, representing the community's commitments to its elders. In fact, this past Sunday celebrated their 25th anniversary. Congratulations. Paul, the executive director of Charles House, brings a personal commitment to services for people with aging issues. Along with experience and administrative skills honed in his previous positions, Paul holds a master's degree in hospital administration from the University of Minnesota, a bachelor's of social work from the University of Kansas. He began his career with a focus on elder care and aging services as a social worker and activities director in long-term care facilities in the Midwest. Paul gained experience as an administrator, leading the development of geriatric services for a hospital system in Colorado, notably heading up the establishment of adult day services, very similar to the Charles House. Paul and his wife, Sally Freeman, came to know firsthand the challenges facing caregiving families when together they cared for Sally's parents in their home through the last 2 years of her parents' lives. Sally and Paul have led adult daycare programs in the past, and the two have sons living near Hillsboro. We have to include this. Well, Paul, I know that was a big lead up, but welcome to the program.
Thank you, Leanne. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, you know, we are just so thrilled. I know I had to give a lot of background, largely because...
Because I'm old.
Oh, sorry. You're not old.
I have a lot of background.
Well, no, I think that what we're learning, and is I get all like excited about this program, particularly at the final episode in the series, because you're really standing on top of a mountain, And I think that you have this extreme insight, both by your credentials, your career, your experience, not only what it is you did at the Charles House, but also your own personal choices caring for Sally's parents. So I'm afraid you just come with a whole lot of experience.
Thank you.
So what I'd like to do is this. I really hope that at the end of today's broadcast, the listener will get some insight into our community where you work and the direction where it's going, and perhaps also get a sense in your own words what it is you've learned and where you think the direction of the Charles House and places like this are going. It's kind of a tall order. Are you up for it?
We're ready. Let's do it, Leanne.
All right, Paul. So tell us, how did, in your own words, the idea come about?
So Charles House started 25 years ago by a caregiving family, a local resident who had been a leader, a pastor, and also a leader in the civil rights movement in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. In Chapel Hill. After he retired, developed a dementia and a sleep apnea and so he was being cared for by his wife, Dorcas, and his daughter, Beppy, and her husband, who were still working full time. And so they were looking for something just like Charles House, a day center where he could go to be engaged during the day, being recognized as the person he had been throughout his life. And respected for that and held in that way, as well as to provide support for the family so they can go to work and the wife could get some respite and support. Not finding it, they just set out to create it. And so that man was Charles Jones, which is where the name Charles House came from. He was the first participant. And so that's where the name came from. That's where the impetus came from. So it came from the very personal experience of a caregiving family who had a very defined idea of what is right about how we treat, interact, care for the elders in our lives. And that's the foundation by which Charles House started and is the beacon that still carries us forward.
So that DNA, mm-hmm. that germ of truth is we were born out of the care, out of wanting to care better, do something better for our elders. Mm-hmm. We had, many of us still work, you know, families' lives got a little busier maybe in the past 50 years, maybe yeah. past 100 years. But now the impulse was, I want to do this better. This is a pure mm-hmm. courage cocktail, by the way. This
yeah,
is like a
this is it.
Vexing issues.
I know.
We need new medicine for vexing
That's
issues.
Right.
So the next question then would be, why did the community matter so deeply? We know the founders matter.
Mm-hmm.
How does it work?
So there are several definitions of community I want to touch on. One, the community. So this was not an endeavor of – it was not an entrepreneurial endeavor. It was not a for-profit endeavor. This was an endeavor that this family said that my father represents – he represents the best of our community. He represents the people who've made our community what it is. And they – and these people are now in their later years needing support, needing help to maintain levels of independence and engagement and so forth. So they reached out to the community, and the community grabbed on to that and said, yes. As you said in our mission statement, we represent our community's commitment to its elders. And so the community took on this task to say that we, as a community, need to have a place like Charles House for those caregiving families and those members of our community.
And how does – what shape did that take?
So that – it started out with people who ponied up money to make it happen, of course. Okay. And there's a lot of that continues on. We've just come through a capital campaign, our 25th anniversary campaign, and the community continues to support the organization financially so that we can be a resource for families of all means. And it also takes the form of engagement. So our community is engaged with these people. So in many cases, people get shuffled off to places, and there are places for people like that. But in the Charles House support of caregiving families who are carrying this journey, this task, these tasks, Charles House is a place where they stay integrated in the community. So children participate, school groups participate, civic groups participate, people with individual talents and desires and skills share what they have. And so that sense of community in itself is telling these people they're still worthy. They're still worthy of what we as a community have to offer. You are still worthy to learn what I have to share. You're still worthy of my time. So it's a huge message to say to these people, you are still part of the community. And while they're at Charles House, many of them participate in projects that are community service projects and are giving back to the community. So they come to Charles House, they aren't just receivers, they are givers. They get to create things that go to the children's library, to the hospital, they make dog biscuits for the animals, the dogs at the animal shelter and things like this. And so they are integrated into community. And then their families are integrated in community as well. There is sometimes nothing as isolating as being a caregiving family.
Oh, please talk about this for our listener. I know what you're saying. Tell us what you know.
So it's out of really good intention that people in our lives will say things like, oh, you shouldn't be doing that, being a caregiver. You know, there are places for your mother. You know, you shouldn't ruin your life. You know, and it's well-intentioned, but it is exemplary of our cultural bias toward institution and institutionalizations. We think that there are people, some kind of professional, that's going to be better at it than I am. Hmm. And there are some families who decide that, no, I'm the person, we're the people who are going to be better at it. Nobody knows him like we do. We're the people who need to do this, you know? So that's one way that it's isolating. It's isolating also because it's brand new territory. It's, you know, it's a whole new set of skills. It's not unlike becoming a parent. I mean, none of us go through school and get a certificate before we, you know.
Launch them off?
launch them out and then off. And, each one of those, you know. And this is just another part of that. This is another part of that life process.
Well, it's odd you should say that, Paul, because I was thinking, as you were describing, well, you know, insulation or not insulation, but isolation, and there's an insularity in institutions. Yeah. We make a lot of the similar decisions when we were describing or figuring out what was the best high school, what was the best college for our youngin. And in that process, we realized that high school was probably not the best place to insist upon, you know, complete independence, but college might be. So we shipped her north. Mm-hmm. God bless her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed.
But I have to tell you that those decisions and the choices and the investigation, they were completely hers. She had a lot to say in this decision. So I'm suspecting that maybe the participants of your programs may have something to say about their joining.
Yes. Most of the folks that are coming to Charles House in our day program and in our residential care settings are people who have enough executive function loss that they are limited in how much they can participate on the rational side of the decision making. And I say that because I say there's another side of the decision making, which is the affect side of decision making.
I think I have a handle on this, but I'd like you to explain it in very simple terms, executive
Uh-huh. So executive function. So here's a scenario of executive function loss. So it's the caregiving couple, and she says, the wife says, "We're doing great. We're doing fine. I don't need help. You know, he's walking the dog every day. He reads the newspaper. You know, our daughter comes and helps out a little bit. And, you know, we've got a nice routine. Things are going well." Okay. And then executive function loss sets in and it sounds like this. "He got lost last week walking the dog, so I can't let him walk the dog by himself anymore. He's looking at the newspaper, but I don't know if he's really reading it. We don't go to the movies anymore. It's too hard for him to sit through a movie. You know, he's asking me, you know, 300 times a day, what are we doing next? What are we doing now? You know, what's happening today?" You know, and so she's starting to really grasp that she's not only carrying out her own executive function for where they are, where they're going, how we're managing. She's having to do that minute by minute for someone else. Mm. So that executive function loss really is when a caregiving dyad or situation really needs to be on board for starting to expand their definition and their system of caregiving.
Okay. That was so helpful. And you say this so respectfully in terms of what's involved, not only from the participant's perspective, but the family, the other partner, or in some cases it could be children. There's a variety of reasons.
It's a variety.
So our listener knows, I have the advantage of having had the privilege of speaking and visiting you before the program. But the composition of your participants is about 80% of people with cognitive impairments.
That's right. That's right. At any one time, there are about 70, 80 caregiving families in our community who are using Charles House as their primary support.
Wow, it's their primary support.
Right.
So that means 3 days a week?
Yeah, or 5 days a week. Even if it's 1 day a week, it's still, they're getting into it and it's their anchor.
Okay,
I didn't realize that.
Okay.
And so they're learning, they're learning about the resources in the community. They're learning from us and from other family caregivers, you know, what do we have to look forward to? Mm. What are some of the challenges that are coming up and all of that? And so 80% or plus of the families that come to Charles House are dealing with issues of dementia, diagnosed, undiagnosed, various stages, some just coming out of mild cognitive impairment, you know, before there's definition of vascular or frontal temporal or Alzheimer's or Lewy body or any of those kinds of things.
So all these diagnoses kind of like, they're almost like, oh, that's just the icing on the cake, Leanne.
Yeah, exactly.
They don't, that's not just driving our families to find us. It's this notice in behavioral change that has in some ways become so noticeable or so dramatic that it's a hazard to the participant perhaps and also to.
Yeah, and becoming a burden, so to speak, you know, for the caregiver too, struggling to figure out how to deal with those kinds of things.
So I really would like you to describe to me what you think of on this journey and talk to us about this journey of the caregiver, of the participant. How does it look? What does it feel like?
For them or for me?
Well, believe me, for both of you.
So
it matters to me what you feel too.
Yeah, so we touched on part of it, the idea of isolation. So let's look at their experience. And some of the experiences that are shared with me that they have are besides isolation. So isolation looks like this. It's you know, we used to play bridge every Tuesday night. We can't do that anymore. You know, We used to have a dinner date, you know, with two other couples, and that's gotten too difficult. It's too hard to manage a restaurant anymore. That our friends have stopped coming around. They're uncomfortable. Okay? So that's one scenario. Then there's the internal experience, and that is, am I doing it right? Who's going to tell me what's right? I mean, I might be doing this all wrong. I mean, some days nothing I do is right. Nothing gets me a result that I can live with, you know? And so there's internal questioning, confusion. You know, it's like I Google for information. I ask my doctor for information. I'm looking for information. The Alzheimer's Association has information and so forth, and I'm piecing it together. So they're on a very intense track of learning. They are educating themselves and learning new vocabularies, clinical vocabularies, and, you know, behavioral, psychological.
I was going to say emotional vocabularies. Emotional vocabularies.
It's a whole new vocabulary.
So there, it's a hodgepodge feeling right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the experience that I had when I went over to you on site was there is a tremendous resource of shared information for your families.
Right.
That is reassuring. Perhaps it's hopeful because you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also this kind of underlying sense that doubt. Are we doing the right thing? And I think that when we're confronted with transitions in families' lives and health particularly, mm-hmm. I think the doubt, you know, there's an old expression, and the expression goes like this. It says, don't dig up in doubt what you planted in faith.
That's good.
Right? I don't know who said it. I can't give the attribution.
Yeah.
But the doubt seems to undermine our overall abilities to build a narrative, to invite brothers and sisters into a conversation, to examine. Doubt does wonderful things. It allows us to examine more honestly what's not working. Mm. And well, it might not be right. I don't know if I'm doing the right thing, but at least I'm trying.
Right.
But I think people all over the country, all over the world, who are listening into this show, need to have a handle on there are resources, there are established practices that have been many people have found helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Charles House has such a resource.
Yeah, Charles House is unique that way. I want to go back to what you're saying about the families. And
yes,
that is,
please.
I want to like twist the doubt idea a little bit.
Oh, please do.
Because I like your idea that doubt is informative and that we can open ourselves up to new thinking by being in doubt. The other side of it is that if we bring ourselves out of isolation and know that we must be in connection, not just us as caregivers, but the people we're caring for have to have social connection to make life continue worthwhile and good. And I need to be in connection with people who do understand what I'm going through. And in that doubt gets alleviated because we're all just trying. And in fact, there is nothing wrong. I got great intuition. I do know this person better than anyone else. And I am the person who can make this happen. Even on the days that I fumble, I'm still there to pick up the ball and keep running. You know, and that reassurance is encouraging. It's a courage cocktail. It's encouragement. It's validation. As I said, we have an institutional bias. So for someone who's doing it on their own, that validation is very important.
I know that this particular courage cocktail is going to brew extra fast because I'm grasping on every word or hanging on every word. It certainly has touched home on many levels. But one question I'd like to ask you to spend some time with, we know that the Charles House Association is here, Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Right.
But there are parts of that organization that you might be able to find in other parts of the country and perhaps other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So those local and non-local listeners, can you give us a plan or some suggestions to help them?
Right. So if you embark on coming out of isolation.
Embark on coming out of isolation. ingredient number one for this mm-hmm. courage cocktail.
Yeah, right.
Big deal.
You want to look at your at the resources available. So you can start with the big ones, the Alzheimer's Association, the Parkinson's Association, you know, services for the blind, you know, all of the things that we do for disabilities and so forth. And find out in your state, in your region, in your area, what those services are.
Would a medical center know that? Would your doctor be able to help you?
No. The best place to go for that, well, I shouldn't be so blunt to say no.
I raised my eyebrows, and you can't see it. But when I hear the word, no, doctors can't help, I'm like,
no, I didn't really? Say doctors can't help. I said that's not the best use of a doctor's expertise.
Great, great. Okay. Got it.
That there are other people with that expertise to go to. And they would be, if you're finding yourself in a healthcare in a hospital, for instance, and this is your trigger, your hospitalization and doing it, you can start by talking to the social workers at the hospital and get information from them to start embarking on that process. Most communities have services for seniors. Sometimes they're public, sometimes they're countywide, or they're urban, they're municipal services, or they are regional. So that would be the local place to go to start talking to people who know what the landscape looks like. Mm-hmm. There are online resources that you can find easily, whether they're clinical resources, services resources. There's the family caregiving. There's caregiving.com. There's the, and these are federally funded resources. There's the area agencies for aging throughout the country, and they're another source of services. So this is learning to know what is the landscape of resources available to me as a caregiving family.
In zip code,
Yeah, absolutely.
41820.
Yeah, that's right. It
doesn't matter.
You go and you start getting the lay of the land to know. One of the things that I tell family caregivers, is that it is time for you to make the transition from seeing yourself as the primary caregiver to being the manager or administrator of the caregiving system.
Let's say that again.
Let's do that. That's number two.
That's like a huge chunk of ingredient that I might need to carve up. Say that again, Paul. That's a big deal.
If you're the primary caregiver in a family, of whatever makeup, it is your job to transpose your identity from being the primary caregiver, the one who does it all, the one who has to carry it all himself, herself, to being the manager of the caregiving system. So that is, that's everybody. That's when my daughter's here on Thursdays, that's the caregiver that comes in who helps with personal care. That's the transportation. That's the, who's helping us out with this piece and that piece. It's managing that. And yeah, I'm also the person who's here every night. I'm also the person who's here every morning, but I'm not the only person. And I need to not be the only person. I need to stop thinking I should be the only person.
I understand what you're saying. And so this kind of flattening of care all of a sudden starts to be higher. You're starting mm-hmm. to build a structure here mm-hmm. where, this person's role is transcending that of I am the only gig in town to I have to organize all these things because people are helping me. And that in itself could be many people might think that mm-hmm. that's harder in some ways than actually being the caregiver.
Yeah, right.
How do you counter that? Preservation?
So one big piece of that whole thing mm-hmm. is taking care of yourself. So that's another piece of that. You have to manage so that you have carved in specific time, activity, whatever it needs, you need to take care of yourself. So that's time off. That's still being able to do something you enjoy doing. That means, finding a way to still have lunch with your friends or participate in a class or something. You have to carve that. You have to be able to take care of yourself, rejuvenate yourself to keep going.
And the way that you see this and the way you've described it for us, I know we're coming to the bottom of the hour, but The point I'd like us to break on the first half is this, that this process isn't something that happens, oh, one day I wake up and now all of a sudden I am no longer the major caregiver. I am the person who manages the caregiver. I imagine this process might unfold over a period of time.
Absolutely. It also unfolds with the needs of the person who's the focus of caregiving.
So Paul, stay with us on this conversation. What I'd like to do when we get back, are you ready for this? I'm going to take you on an audio tour of the Charles House, and I have three little tracks. After break, I'm going to play. I'll cue them up with you, and you'll get a sense of the sounds and the activities. And listener, while you're out there getting your sweet tea, I will be back in a little while. Station identification. Stay tuned, because we're going to talk about what it looks like in a day-to-day activity at the Charles House, and that's important for you if you're not in this area, what you might be reasonable expectations of other programs. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Courage Cocktail Radio Show. I'm your host, Leanne McClymont. Glad you are with us. The first half of our show, we were describing having a conversation with Paul Cleaver. Paul is the executive director of the Charles House Association. The reason that cocktail seemed to brew so quickly was that he was introducing two fresh ingredients to our listeners, and which we will review together. But the point we're going to now is I promised you all that we would take an audio tour of the Charles House. And I have a few sound bites. Paul, I'm going to cue these up. You're still here on mic. The first one, soundtrack, is the introduction of me walking into a room, kind of a crowded room, I might add, where people were playing some games. Listen to this.
Four. All right, Max, so this will be the final one, so go ahead and pick any color you like.
I guess I'd get a better green somewhere.
All right, a green one.
Those who wish to sing always find a Swedish proverb.
Oh, a Swedish proverb. Those who wish to sing always find a song.
I thought that was, I couldn't have planned that as I'm walking in with my mic, not undercover, by the way.
Yeah.
But can you tell our listener what's up with this? Tell us.
So this is a game that we play in our 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock afternoon time when people have a choice of a whole myriad of activities. People who want to walk will walk, and people who want to rest can listen to a story, and people who want to work on a community service project can do that as well. But this is the game, and so we have a cluster of games. This one is actually one that's been developed at Charles Hill called Thumbs Up, and it's made so that a group, and I don't know if there were six people around the table.
There were plenty of people around that table.
And so they play a game. It has the feel of a board game. They roll a dice, a marker gets moved, and then they get to choose the color of a pile of cards, depending on where their marker lands. So, you know, so it's a board game. So that's normal for all of us to play a board game. And in this board game, he chose the color, and the next card was a Swedish proverb. And so for those who can read, they get to read. And for those who can't read, they've selected the card, and the card is read. And then what they do is they have they're asked their opinion. And their opinion is either thumbs up, I like it, thumbs down, I don't like it. If they like it, they get to keep the card.
Now listen, I have to confess to you, listener, I edited out the thumbs up comment, not knowing the context.
I said,
thumbs up. Oh, okay, we just have so much time, but now I understand.
Yeah. So there's no right or wrong.
Right.
Because it doesn't matter. I mean, you either like it or you don't like it, but you've made a determination, and then you either get the card or you've sacrificed the card.
Right. I get it. Now, we see this, and I have another track coming up here, and I have to do a big shout out. Today, we have Ernie Hood helping us out as soundboard engineer. Ernie is my colleague. He hosts and produces the radio show Radio in Vivo, which broadcasts from 11 a.m. to noon every Wednesday. That's the slot right before Courage Cocktail. So we're neighbors in programming, and I needed some help with today's soundboard. So, Ernie, thanks so much for helping. We have another track. Now, don't get discouraged by this track. It's about a minute long, and there's lots of busy sounds in it. I really would like you to hang in there with me. It's 58 seconds long. Listen to the whole thing.
Yep. Hi, Catherine. Come on in.
Well, there's a crowd coming. Thanks, Sarah. They'll be here in just a minute.
They'll be here in just a minute. The reason I played such a fairly long tag was that there's a gentility among the people who are there. And I don't even know if they're employees. I don't know if they're volunteers. I couldn't tell. I didn't care. Even as a reporter, what I cared more about was this genuine sense of inclusion. And people were very eager, by the way, to get into that room. And there's an atmosphere that I thought was quite beautiful.
Thank you. It's what you were recording was the chaos.
That's chaos. Sign me up.
of having everybody come from their various chosen activities together all in one room in a big circle of chairs in preparation for the afternoon music program, participatory music program. And so you did that was fabulous, the way you captured the sense of invitation and joining and inclusion and direction that wasn't bossy.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
As I was so cautious to be unobtrusive, and I always talk to the listener about how I get these sounds. And I also have to notice, I would like you to help me understand that these transitions are very important to human, to the participants of the program, because they bring with them a sense of normalcy, beginning, middle, and ending. There's a sense of closure. There's also a great sense of expectation.
Mm-hmm.
And I sensed that. And of course, our final track, which I will play in a few minutes, is the gentleman, a very talented pianist called Eric Leith. And Eric is singing here and with his piano. And maybe the best thing to do is listen to this track. I'm not sure if you could hear it, but there were people dancing, and I tried to pick up the sound of their feet tapping and dancing away.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just beautiful moment for me to be in there. I'm so thankful that you allowed me in.
Right. Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And you could see what a great role music plays. You know, we think of music, we do a lot now. There's the memory and music program and doing individual playlists and so forth. But there's something really magical about people sharing music and letting music speak. So, you know, we can lose language, but lyrics and music resides in a different part of our brain than language. So we may be aphasic. We may not be able to conjure up words when we need to, but give me a song and I'm going to sing the whole thing through for you. It's there. And so it activates from a whole different part of the brain, and socially it activates a whole different social language than words.
Oh, I can't tell you how socially. If you heard a voice, there was a lovely lady sitting next to me. I was sitting in the back, and I felt for a moment there, I closed my eyes, and this isn't a shout out to Nordstrom's, but it's going to sound like it. But Nordstrom's in our community has a beautiful piano. And oftentimes you get certain times of the week, there'll be a pianist there. And you just see people relaxing. And it's a total different social mode when you start hearing that piano and start people drawing around and just feeling more comfortable and in some ways more grown up. There's a certain element there that where's the smoking? Where's the cocktail?
Right. That's right. I mean, and they're asking each other to dance.
Yes.
Staff is encouraging interaction. They're asking people to dance, and so it is. It's very, there should be cocktails, but it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
But in reclaiming that part of our identity, the maturity, the sophistication, and Eric does a great job too. He had some extremely beautiful music he was playing.
Yeah.
And then the other thing I noticed, and this may seem extremely small detail, but people were reading from word sheets. And there was this process. It wasn't a book. Everyone would get a sheet of words and lyrics and then hand it back. And then in the next series would be another group of song words. And I thought that was absolutely amazing to watch this process unfold.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's one of the ways that we create high touch.
What's that about? I knew something was going on, but I can't come up with a cute title.
It's
high touch.
It's interaction. So instead of being told to turn to page 274, you get to say, let me give you the song sheet for the next song. And there's an interaction. in that moment.
And I know that something magical was happening because I witnessed it, mm-hmm. and I kept on watching it, and I was mm-hmm. this is as much as a part of it mm-hmm. as the actual
right.
singing.
Right.
So these things are they're nuanced. I think most of us would notice them, maybe not be able to label them, mm-hmm. but this experience at the Charles House are these things that you would find everywhere?
Unfortunately not. You know, because as I've already said, we have a cultural bias toward institutionalization, but also we haven't created a new paradigm in our vernacular, our cultural vernacular for this phase of life.
Paul, why do you think that is?
Yeah, well, denial has kept us from wanting to look at it, but more and more of us are going to be looking at it, both personally and in our families and in our friends and so forth. So it's going to become more normalized. And Charles House is a real example of how do we normalize this time of life.
Well, I think we have to talk to Amazon Prime,
yeah.
their video company, and say it's time to do a reality uh-huh. show or
yeah.
something like that.
That'd be fun. Yeah. You know, and so not only institutionalization, but what you said about the adult thing, there's
yes.
also a bias toward, and I'm going to use the term even though it's harsh, infantilization.
Infantilization.
That's a bad word. Let me try another one. But that's where we become paternalistic, and we see people as children because
oh.
that's our reference.
You know,
it's like, well, it's just like he's a toddler again. You know, well, no, he's not a toddler again. Yeah, there are similarities about how we care for people, but it doesn't make him a toddler. And so it's easy for us to fall into what we've known in dealing with toddlers instead of working to take on a new vernacular for how we are with these people. And we don't take away their dignity and their adultness, you know. We have to treat them as if they really are still the people they are.
Sometimes I wondered, as I sat there, and I had to fight for my seat. I did it in a nice way,
yeah.
but that was like
yeah.
a big day. I often wondered, I wonder if the families of these participants get to do what I did. Do they get to watch some of these events, or even with or without their person, so to develop an internal capacity to lead into a direction that's more respectful and not childlike?
Yeah, I think that they take it up by osmosis, but they also contribute to it because it's their general instinct. I want to say that's me being kind of hopeful, but also
are we looking through rosy glasses?
I'm hoping not.
Okay.
But that's because so I because I have so here's one of my sidekicks. You know, we use a term.
You have so many of them.
We use a term out there called the informal caregiver.
The informal caregiver.
There are formal caregivers and informal caregivers. So the formal caregivers are the people with certificates okay. and degrees, and you know they work for organizations. So
generally, they may get paid.
Yeah, and they get paid. Okay. And then the informal are the non-paid family members, neighbors that are helping, all that sort of thing, and they're called the informal caregiving. Okay. They're the largest group of workforce in our society, unpaid. The families are providing $400-500 billion worth of care in our economy free. And they're doing it, as I've said before, they're doing it right. Yeah. And there's nothing informal about them. They're smart, they're educated, they know, they're learning, they're adapting, they're very flexible, you know. So to use the term informal feels like a put down to me.
Oh, yeah. But it also features this, that in that the dialectic or in the narrative, collective mm-hmm. narrative of mm-hmm. the story, that's going to continue to unfold and it's going to go like a tsunami, I think,
yeah.
based on
right.
any age dynamics. But when you consider that these are people for whom their lives have changed dramatically,
right.
Both the participants in your program and their families, probably at the first sight of a diagnosis or first walking out of a, you know, something that a doctor or has informed them, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah. It is transformative. There's an Australian named Christine Bryden who for 20 years has been writing about her personal experience of being a person living with dementia.
Ah, I've heard that name before.
And
she has dementia.
She writes books. She's written, I think, 3 books about her experience, about what it's like to be a person living with dementia.
And thus giving voice.
Giving voice.
For that.
For them. So we stop looking at them and we start looking at life with them.
Ah.
So she says that dementia is a journey. It's a journey from the realms of rationality through emotion and into spirit. And I say that caregiving is joining in that journey. So when you join in that journey, that means that you got at least 2 people on that journey into a new realm of being, a realm that isn't based on words and logic, but moves into meaning and symbolism and letting go. And so there's a new vocabulary. There are new skills, you know. There are new ways that we interact with people.
I was, I think that was very helpful, Paul. I was at a talk, and it was at a Gloria Steinem talk. I know, what an icon. But the thing, the take-home message to me was this. She spent 2 years after college, she spent 2 years in India. And she said everything in her life changed for her in India, not after Smith. I'm like, what? She said that in India she learned that we are all linked. We are not ranked.
Oh, even in India.
In India, and this is in the late 60s.
Yeah.
And the significance of that is exactly what you're saying, is that when we see ourselves as being linked with each other, within each other, so to speak,
right.
Rather than roles and ranking and these the language falls apart.
Right.
Particularly when we start describing a journey away from sentience, if that's the right word, into something that's not as robust, maybe.
Yeah.
But equally valid.
Right. You know, to be a little philosophical, now that we've gone to India.
Yeah.
You know,
come on in.
I mean, one of the main kind of tenets of many religions is learning how to live in the here and now, in the present. So part of going into this journey with somebody who is, it's not just dementia, but that's the main piece of, you know, a big piece of what's happening in our society. But when you enter into the journey with someone, you both are teaching each other how to walk into the journey. It isn't that one person's in charge. Look, when you say rank, it isn't that one person's in charge and the other person has to be obedient. You know, it's they get to do it and teach each other to do it. And a big piece of that is learning to live in the moment. That what happened in the past and what's happening in the future isn't nearly as important or even as meaningful as what's happening right now.
It is what it is. It's, I think this was extremely, you've introduced a shift of paradigm to me and hopefully our listener to get a sense of, yes, one of these approaches isn't about bricks and mortar. It isn't necessarily about websites and knowledge can be found there, but it's our perspective on what the invitation really is. And that was something that changed me. So I'm very grateful to have done this brew of Courage Cocktail, the wrap-up of a five-part series with you over at Charles House. I know time is of the essence here. You celebrated 25 years. Was it exciting? Was it a great party?
It was a great party. We had beloved North Carolina authors D.G. Martin and Jill McCorkle and Clyde Edgerton reflecting on their life experiences with aging and how it reflects in their fiction and in their characters, which was terribly on point. The musicians who started the Red Clay Ramblers of North Carolina fame were there to celebrate with us, and it was a great celebration.
What do you hope in the future, not only for the Charles House, but if I could say to you, Paul, we're going to brew this cocktail 10 years from now. Hopefully we'll have many more between this. What would you like to be able to tell me?
Well, we know that more and more, there'll be hardly any of us that won't be touched by the subjects that we've talked about today, that we're going to have people in our lives, that we will become people that will be the cause for for these discussions and so forth. And the vast majority of people who need help with support get it exclusively from their friends and families. They're not getting it from buildings and facilities and professionals. We have to depend on each other, and we have to start the discussion in our families. You think the discussion about dying is hard. Start the discussion about, will you take care of me when I can't take care of myself?
Got it.
And to say to somebody, if something happens to you that you need someone to take care of you, I want you to know that I'm that person.
That's right. Sometimes some people in your life, you don't need to be asked. You just show up.
Mm-hmm.
So having that confidence to know that, hey, I won't be alone, it's good to know.
Yeah.
I can encourage you and hope you continue to thrive over at the Charles House. We're so fortunate to have had you as our final episode, and we're going to stay in touch. I promise you, listener, this is a topic that we will return to. So I want to thank you all for listening, and especially those who are listening to our five series in totality. Podcasts are available, of course, at WCOMFM.org. Just come on out there, and you can also find Courage Cocktail Radio Show on Facebook as well as on Twitter. I want to thank Ernie again, Ernie in Radio in Vivo. Come on in early, tune in at 11 a.m., and you'll listen to his program. And it's always a pleasure to be with you. Thanks for listening. This is Leanne McClymont of Courage Cocktail Radio Show. You bring the lunch, and I'll bring the Courage Cocktail.